Hello, I'm Linda Feinberg, President of FINRA Dispute Resolution. Thank you for listening to our workshop on FINRA's new motion to dismiss rules, what you need to know. Before we explore our main topic, we will update you on recent activities and discuss the operation of FINRA's National Arbitration and Mediation Committee, which we refer to as the NAMC. First, let me give you an update on case filings. We closed our books for 2008 and found that case filings increased 54% from 2007. Investor cases, which account for about 75% of our overall caseload, increased 94% from 2007. We anticipated this increase because our caseload is generally countercyclical to the markets. Subprime mortgages and auction rate securities cases account for a large part of this increase. In 2008, FINRA received 813 cases involving subprime mortgage issues and 301 cases involving auction rate securities. Now let's take a minute to talk about how FINRA is handling these auction rate securities cases. FINRA, our enforcement arm that is, the Securities and Exchange Commission, and several states have announced settlements relating to the sale of auction rate securities. So far, more than 20 brokerage firms have agreed in principle to buy back these securities and to offer certain investors, usually individuals, small businesses, charities, and foundations, the opportunity to arbitrate under FINRA's auspices disputes over consequential damages. FINRA has posted on its website the special arbitration procedures for claims filed by eligible customers of the firms that have entered into final regulatory settlements with FINRA and with the SEC. We have also published on our website a list of frequently asked questions to guide parties and counsel on the special procedures. Eligible investors can use the special arbitration procedures or, at their election, bring a case under standard arbitration rules or in any other forum where they may have the right to seek redress. Under the special arbitration procedures, firms will pay all arbitration fees. Also under the special arbitration procedures, firms cannot contest liability related to the illiquidity of these holdings or to the sales, including any claims of misrepresentations or omissions by the firm's sales agents. To speed the process under the special procedures, a single chair-qualified public arbitrator will decide cases claiming consequential damages under $1 million. In cases with consequential damage claims of $1 million or more, the parties can agree to expand the panel to 3 public arbitrators. As of February 23rd, 12 investors have elected to participate in the special arbitration procedures. You can find out more about the special arbitration procedures by visiting our website at www.finra.org and clicking on Arbitration and Mediation. When you get to that site, then click on Resources for Parties and Panel Composition in Auction Rate Arbitration Cases. Now let me give you an update on the Public Arbitrator Pilot Program. Last year we launched an innovative 2-year pilot program that allows some investors to choose a panel made up of 3 public arbitrators instead of 2 public arbitrators and 1 non-public arbitrator. This program will allow us to see if a change in the way arbitration panels are selected is a better way to serve and protect the interests of investors. We are evaluating the pilot by measuring the following indicators. The percentage of investors who opt into the pilot and who choose a 3-member public panel after opting in. The results of pilot and non-pilot investor cases, including the percentage of cases that settle and the awards of arbitrators. The length of hearings and the use of expert witnesses in pilot versus non-pilot cases. We also plan to evaluate the pilot by surveying the parties, counsel, and arbitrators. As of February 23rd, FINRA received 265 cases that are eligible for the pilot. Investors in 138 cases elected to participate in the pilot program. In addition to the new motions to dismiss rule, which we will talk about in a few minutes, the SEC recently approved our rule to increase the limit for a single arbitrator to decide a case up to $100,000. We last increased the limit in 1998. Under amended rules 12401 and 13401, a single chair-qualified arbitrator will decide cases up to $100,000 unless all parties agree to three arbitrators. Raising the limit for claims heard by a single arbitrator will increase efficiencies and decrease costs. We expect to reduce case processing time because of the flexibility in scheduling conference calls and hearing dates with one arbitrator instead of three. The new rule will go into effect for all cases filed on or after March 30th. Now let me tell you about some new faces that will be leading two of FINRA's regional offices. As mentioned during the last workshop, DR employees who retired last year included, among others, Elizabeth Clancy, former Northeast Region Director, Jean Feeney, former Chief Counsel, and Judith Norris, former West Region Director. We appointed Catherine Baer as the new Northeast Region Director and Laura McNamire as the new West Region Director. You will find that Catherine and Laura are experienced dispute resolution professionals who can rapidly respond to case administration issues. Please feel free to contact either of them with any questions or concerns that you have. I'm also delighted to announce that Ken Andrechik will be assuming the additional role of Chief Counsel in addition to his current responsibilities. His new title is Senior Vice President, Chief Counsel, and Director of Mediation and Strategy. Now, the next topic on our agenda is the National Arbitration and Mediation Committee. The NAMC advises FINRA dispute resolution and the FINRA board on a range of things, including recruitment, qualification, training, and evaluation of arbitrators and mediators, evaluation of existing rules and procedures, and new rules, procedures, and procedures to govern the conduct of all arbitration, mediation, and other dispute resolution matters before FINRA. The chair of the NAMC is a public member, and a majority of the NAMC consists of public members. There are currently 13 members, 7 public and 6 non-public. The NAMC, which meets 3 times a year, includes representatives from diverse constituent groups, including attorneys who represent investors, attorneys who represent the securities industry, as well as members from FINRA's roster of arbitrators and mediators. This diverse group ensures a neutral approach in the administration of our forum, promoting fairness for all parties. A list of the current NAMC members is available on the FINRA website. Again, that's www.finra.org. Click on Arbitration and Mediation, then click About FINRA Dispute Resolution, and then click on National Arbitration and Mediation Committee. The NAMC recently helped us develop the new rules on motions to dismiss, which is the main workshop topic today. I'm delighted to welcome two of FINRA Dispute Resolution's regional directors who will be the principal speakers for this workshop. Rose Schindler is regional director of our Southeast Regional Office, and Scott Carfello is regional director of our Midwest Regional Office. First, Scott, help us understand what we are talking about when we refer to a motion to dismiss.
A motion to dismiss is a party's request that the arbitrators eliminate some or all of the claimant's claims from the case. Before these new rules, a party could file a motion to dismiss for any reason at any stage of an arbitration proceeding. Parties often filed motions before the panel held a hearing. If the arbitrators granted a motion to dismiss before they held a hearing, the non-moving party lost the opportunity to have the arbitrators hear the case.
Rose, I was wondering, why did FINRA need these new rules on motions to dismiss?
In recent years, Linda, we found many cases in which parties filed motions to dismiss which could have the effect of delaying hearings and increasing investors' costs. The motions also could intimidate less sophisticated investors. We also found cases in which the same party filed multiple motions to dismiss in the same case. FINRA became concerned that the number of motions to dismiss filed in investor cases had begun to increase starting in 2004. Even though arbitrators deny most motions to dismiss, FINRA became concerned that if left unregulated, this type of motion practice would limit investors' access to the forum, either by making arbitration too costly or by denying investors their right to have their claims heard in arbitration. In November 2007, we filed our amended rule proposal with the Securities and Exchange Commission. The new rules will limit significantly the number of motions to dismiss in FINRA's forum. The new rules also impose strict sanctions against parties who engage in abusive motion practices. We added new Rule 12504 to the Code of Arbitration Procedure, which is Rule 13504 in the Industry Code. In the same rule filing, we also proposed to amend the rule for motions to dismiss based on eligibility grounds. That's current Rule 12206 of the Code of Arbitration Procedure and Rule 13206 of the Industry Code, which provides that no claim is eligible for arbitration where 6 years have elapsed from the occurrence or event giving rise to the claim. The SEC approved the new rules on December 31st, 2008, and they apply to all motions to dismiss filed on or after February 23rd, 2009. We published Regulatory Notice 09-07 announcing the new rules on January 23rd, 2009. FINRA believes the new rules will curb abuses and ensure that investors have arbitrators hear their claims at an evidentiary hearing.
Scott, I'm going to jump in here. Can you give us an overview of how the new rules will work?
The new rules reinforce FINRA's position that parties have the right to a hearing in arbitration by clarifying that pre-hearing motions to dismiss are discouraged in arbitration. The rules significantly limit pre-hearing motions filed prior to the conclusion of a party's case in chief. The new rules provide that arbitrators cannot grant a motion to dismiss before the conclusion of a party's case in chief with three narrow exceptions. The exceptions are, number one, the non-moving party previously released the claim in dispute by a signed settlement agreement and/or written release, or number two, the moving party was not associated with the account, security, or conduct at issue, or number three, the claim is not eligible for arbitration because it does not meet the 6-year time limit on the submission of arbitration claims. Again, that's the eligibility rule. The new rules strictly limit the types of pre-hearing motions on the three narrow exceptions just identified. At the same time, the new rules do not affect the party's right to make a motion to dismiss for any reason after the conclusion of a party's case in chief. A party can make these motions after the conclusion of a party's case in chief on any grounds. The new rule on motions to dismiss spells this out.
Well, as we all know, the devil is always in the details, and we think the application of the three exceptions will be the hardest part of the rule and certainly the most difficult part for arbitrators to apply. Rose, how should arbitrators go about applying these three exceptions?
For the first exception, which is prior settlement or release, a panel cannot act on a pre-hearing motion to dismiss unless the panel determines that the non-moving party previously released the claims in dispute by a signed settlement agreement and/or written release. Parties seeking this exception should provide arbitrators with valid documents that indicate that the claims in the current dispute have been resolved in a previous dispute. For the second exception, not associated with the account, security, or conduct at issue, a panel cannot act on a pre-hearing motion to dismiss unless the panel determines that the moving party was not associated with the accounts, securities, or conduct at issue. FINRA intends this exception to apply in cases involving issues of misidentification. For example, the panel could grant a pre-hearing motion to dismiss if a party files a claim against the wrong person or entity, or a claim names an individual who was not employed by the firm during the time of the dispute. For the third exception of eligibility, a panel may grant a pre-hearing motion to dismiss if the claim is not eligible for submission to arbitration because 6 years have elapsed from the occurrence or event giving rise to the claim. Parties seeking to raise this exception should provide arbitrators with valid documents that indicate when the occurrence or event took place. We emphasize that these exceptions do not constitute an invitation to parties to file pre-hearing motions to dismiss. The fact that a motion may be filed under one of these exceptions does not mean that the panel should or will grant the motion unless it is meritorious.
Scott, let's say a party moves to dismiss the claim, arguing that they were not associated with the account, security, or conduct at issue. As it turns out, the evidence clearly shows that the party did not work at the firm at the time of the alleged wrongful conduct. Are these appropriate grounds for a pre-hearing motion to dismiss under the new rule?
Yes, that's one of the three exceptions for pre-hearing dismissal that we just talked about, cases involving issues of misidentification. This exception would apply to cases in which the claimant filed a claim against the wrong person or against someone that the firm did not employ during the time in dispute.
Rose, do the rules prohibit a party from filing motions to dismiss based on grounds other than the three exceptions after the party concludes its case in chief?
No, they do not, Linda. A party may file a motion to dismiss for any reason after the conclusion of the other party's case in chief. Such motions are not limited to the three exceptions we just discussed. This means that a moving party may file a motion to dismiss at the conclusion of a non-moving party's case in chief, based on any theory of law. FINRA expects these motions to be relevant to the case and based on theories that are germane to the issues raised in the non-moving party's case. FINRA believes that by the close of the non-moving party's case, the panel will have heard enough evidence to decide whether it should consider and, if warranted, grant the motion. We note, however, that if a party files a motion at the conclusion of a non-moving party's case, the panel is not required to consider or to grant the motion. Rather, arbitrators will continue to control the hearing process, which includes deciding whether to hear such a motion.
And Scott, what if a party moves to dismiss the statement of claim based on the alleged failure of the claimant to state a cause of action? Can the arbitrators consider such a motion, and if so, when can they consider it?
Since the alleged failure to state a cause of action is not one of the three specified exceptions for pre-hearing dismissal under the rule, the panel could only consider a motion based on such grounds after the conclusion of the opposing party's case in chief.
And Rose, what about other kinds of motions? For example, does a party have to wait for the close of the other side's case in chief before it makes a motion to dismiss based on alleged abuse of the discovery process?
No, a party may make a motion to dismiss based on alleged abuse of the discovery process pursuant to Rule 12.5.11 of the Code of Arbitration Procedure, which is Industry Code Rule 13.5.11, at any time throughout the case. The new rules also do not apply to motions to dismiss that are based on a party's alleged failure to comply with an order of the panel pursuant to Rule 12.212 of the Code of Arbitration Procedure, which is Industry Code Rule 13.212.
But Rose and Scott are now going to describe the rule's procedural requirements that parties and arbitrators must follow. Rose, first, can you tell us what a party moving to dismiss under the new rules must do in terms of asserting the claim?
First, Linda.
I'm sorry, instead of answering the claim. Let me start all over again. A party moving to dismiss under the new rules must do what with respect to answering the claim and then filing its motion to dismiss?
First, Linda, a party moving to dismiss under the new rules must separately answer the claim. The motion to dismiss must be in writing and filed separately from the answer. This will ensure that parties receive an answer that responds directly to the statement of claim.
And Scott, do the new rules limit when parties may file a motion to dismiss?
If a party is seeking dismissal based on eligibility grounds, the party must file the motion 90 days before the hearing. If a party is seeking dismissal based on the other two grounds, the party must file the motion 60 days before the hearing. Also, parties will have 30 days to respond to a motion to dismiss on eligibility grounds and 45 days to respond to a motion on the other two grounds.
But Scott, what if a party moves to dismiss the statement of claim on eligibility grounds 1 week before the start of the hearing?
The motion is untimely. Under the new rule, a party must file a motion to dismiss on eligibility grounds 90 days before a scheduled hearing.
And Scott, do the new rules require that the full panel hear the motion, or can the chair hear the motion by him or herself?
The new rules require that the full panel must decide a pre-hearing motion to dismiss.
Well, let's say a firm filed an answer and then filed a motion to dismiss based on the grounds that the firm was not associated with the securities at issue in the case. The hearing is 4 months away. Is the firm's motion timely?
Yes, because motions based on the grounds that the firm was not associated with the securities at issue in the case must be filed 60 days before the hearing. The non-moving party has 45 days to respond to the motion. Thereafter, FINRA staff will forward the motion and response to the panel.
But Rose, what if the panel wants to decide a pre-hearing motion to dismiss based on written submissions? Can it do that?
No, it cannot, Linda. The rules require the panel to hold an in-person or telephonic pre-hearing conference on the motion unless the parties waive the hearing. Further, all pre-hearing conferences to decide these motions must be recorded under the new rules. Also under the rules, a panel can only grant a motion to dismiss either in whole or in part if its decision is unanimous. This differs from other provisions of the codes, which provide for determinations by a majority of the arbitrators. FINRA believes that the possibility of the complete dismissal of a claim before an evidentiary hearing justifies the requirement that all arbitrators on the panel must agree before the panel grants the motion.
But Rose, what if only two of the arbitrators want to grant the motion to dismiss? Can they dismiss the case?
No, as I noted previously, the entire panel must agree. The arbitrators cannot grant pre-hearing motions to dismiss under the new rules unless their decision is unanimous.
I see that the new rules require that if a panel grants a motion to dismiss, the panel must write an explanation for its decision. Rose, what does FINRA expect in the way of a written explanation?
The written explanation is only required if the panel grants the motion. No explanation is required if the panel denies the motion. However, if the panel grants a motion to dismiss, arbitrators do not have to write detailed legal opinions. Their explanation should describe the most relevant facts that support their decision to grant dismissal. It should state the general reasons for the arbitrator's decision, but legal authorities are not required.
Scott, what do the arbitrators need to know and do when a party files a motion to dismiss based on eligibility grounds?
As a reminder, Rule 12206 of the Code of Arbitration Procedure, which is Rule 13206 of the Industry Code, bars the arbitration of claims where 6 years have elapsed from the occurrence or event giving rise to the claim. This rule makes clear that dismissal of a claim on eligibility grounds in arbitration does not preclude a claimant from pursuing the claim in court.
But what happens if the arbitrators grant a motion to dismiss based solely on eligibility grounds?
The rules provide by requesting dismissal of a claim on eligibility grounds, the requesting party is agreeing that the claimant may withdraw all of its arbitration's claims without prejudice and instead pursue all of its claims in court. There is an interplay between the rules when a party moves to dismiss on multiple grounds that include eligibility. If a party files a motion to dismiss on several grounds, including eligibility, the panel must decide eligibility first. Eligibility is a threshold issue. Under the rule, if the panel dismisses any claim on eligibility grounds, it may not rule on any other grounds for dismissal until 15 days have passed. This is sort of a timeout. It allows the non-moving party to decide if it wants to move some or all of its case to court.
But Rose, what if a party moves to dismiss the claims on two grounds? The party argues that the arbitrator should dismiss the claim because the claim is barred by the eligibility rule, and also that the party was not employed by the firm at the time of the alleged wrongful conduct. Which grounds for dismissal should the panel consider first?
In that case, the panel must decide eligibility first. If the panel grants the motion to dismiss on eligibility grounds on any claim, it may not rule on any other grounds for the motion to dismiss until the non-moving party decides if it wants to move some or all of its case to court. If the case stays in arbitration after the 15-day timeout, the arbitrators then may consider the remaining grounds for dismissal in accordance with the motion to dismiss rules.
And what do these new rules say about forum fees, attorney's fees, and sanctions in cases involving motions to dismiss?
If the panel denies a pre-hearing motion to dismiss under the new rules, it is required that they assess the forum fees for the hearing on the motion against the moving party. FINRA believes that the mandatory assessment of forum fees will deter parties from filing motions that fall outside the scope of the three exceptions to the rule and will provide an incentive for parties wishing to file such motions to ensure that their pre-hearing motions to dismiss comply with the intent of the rules. The new rules have teeth when it comes to frivolous motions to dismiss. If the panel finds that a party acted frivolously in filing a pre-hearing motion to dismiss, the panel must award reasonable cost and attorney's fees to any party that opposed the motion. This is not the panel's choice. The rule requires it. In terms of discretion, the rule states that the panel may award sanctions if it determines that a party filed a motion in bad faith. Permissible sanctions include monetary penalties, precluding a party from presenting evidence, and/or making a disciplinary referral at the end of the case.
But what if a panel denies a motion to dismiss and one arbitrator believes that the non-moving party should share the cost for the hearing on that motion? Can you provide any guidance about this scenario?
Once the panel decides to deny the motion, which is the case in your scenario, the panel has no discretion. It must assess the forum fees for the hearing on the motion against the moving party.
Scott, what if a party files a 200-page motion to dismiss on the eve of the hearing? Do the new rules address this situation?
If the panel denies the motion and finds it to be frivolous, under the new rules, the panel must award reasonable costs and attorney's fees to the party opposing the motion. If the panel finds that the moving party acted in bad faith in filing the motion, it also may issue other sanctions under Rule 12212 of the Code of Arbitration or Rule 13212 of the Industry Code. In summary, a simple denial of the motion results in forum fees against the moving party. A frivolous motion results in attorney's fees and a finding of bad faith exposes the moving party to the full range of sanctions listed in the codes of arbitration procedure. FINRA believes that the risk of monetary penalties and sanctions imposed either by the panel on its own initiative or as a result of a party's motion will deter parties from filing such motions frivolously or in bad faith. Moreover, FINRA believes these enforcement mechanisms are required to ensure strict compliance with the rules.
Another question, Scott. May a party refile a pre-hearing motion that the arbitration panel has denied?
There's one more procedural safeguard that arbitrators need to know. If the panel denies a motion to dismiss under the new rules, the moving party may not refile the denied motion unless a panel order permits it to be refiled.
But let's now talk a bit about implementation of the new rules. Rose, could you outline what FINRA has done to implement them?
On January 23rd of 2009, FINRA published Regulatory Notice 09-07 on its website. The regulatory notice provides an overview of the new rules and explains that the new rules will apply to all dispositive motions filed on or after February 23, 2009. The regulatory notice provides guidance in a question and answer format. FINRA also published a frequently asked questions document similar to the regulatory notice. FINRA included a link to the frequently asked questions in the What's New section of its website. Additionally, FINRA added the frequently asked questions to the party's reference guide, which is also available on our website. FINRA also updated its claim service letter to include a brief description of the new rules and to refer parties to FINRA's website for more information. FINRA also included the frequently asked questions in the arbitrator's reference guide, which is available on our website. Also, in our cover letter to arbitrators enclosing dispositive motions, FINRA cites the rules, refers to the frequently asked questions on FINRA's website, and asks that arbitrators carefully review the rules before considering such motions. In addition, FINRA intends to publish an article summarizing the new rules in its arbitrator newsletter, The Neutral Corner. FINRA also will send a letter and an email to arbitrators, which will alert arbitrators to the new rules and will enclose the frequently asked questions. Finally, FINRA is also in the process of creating a mini course on the new rules. Neutrals should expect the new course to be available on our website this spring.
This concludes our discussion of FINRA's new motion to dismiss rules. I want to thank Rose and Scott for sharing their knowledge and experience with us. We hope you enjoyed today's workshop and found it informative. And thank you all again for your continued support and hard work as we work together to ensure investor protection and market integrity.